So, ladies and gentlemen, it's the time of the month when the Santa Fe Art Institute does their monthly residence open house. Here with me is Michelle LaFlamme-Childs. Welcome, Michelle.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
And so this is this coming Thursday, July 23rd, at 5:30 in the afternoon at the Santa Fe Art Institute.
That's right.
And you have brought over a whole bunch of residents to the baking company.
We have a full house at the Art Institute, which is, it's just a joy. It's a joy for us as staff to have so many wonderful people floating around, and I think it's great for the artists because they have, and it's such a diversity, you know, of talent. All these different people get to mingle, and you get to see the effect on their work. It's really wonderful, and we have the bulk of them here today.
Excellent. So. And so, by the way, Santa Fe Art Institute is at sfai.org, and they can be reached by phone at 424-5050. You're also blogging?
I just put up a blog. It's sfaiblog.org to make it easy. And so it's not like a constant blogging thing yet. I'm still trying to figure out how to get the tweets in there, and we have a Facebook fan page, and we're all high-tech now.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you ever catch me tweeting, just put me out of my misery.
Tweet, tweet.
So I'd like now to welcome Michael Broman. He is one of the residents at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you on, the second year in a row? Were you here last year?
Yes, I was here last summer.
So you were doing, but I hadn't had a chance to actually see your studio until we met just the other day, and you were using... You're a Western artist, you're from Colorado, mm-hmm. you're working in the West, mm-hmm. and really using the materials of the West in a very conscious manner.
Yes. I mean, that's part of my goal as an artist, is to really define who I am as an artist working in the West and trying to take away some of that myth of the Western artist being in a very specific stereotype, and wanting to bring attention to the fact that there's a really large contemporary Western scene here that isn't just cowboys and Indians. It's looking at the concept, looking at the area, looking at materials, and using some of those materials in a way that can be very specific about the West, but also very universal and accessible to a lot of people. Some of the materials that I use, much to some of the disgust of other people, is horse manure. And I went out very consciously last week and collected horse manures for him.
It's dry.
It's dry. It wasn't when I collected it.
It is now. Ladies and gentlemen, you can come to the studios. Because I went in there and I could barely smell it. It smelled good. It smelled sort of earthy but not stenchy in your studio.
Yeah, and I grew up with horses, so that really doesn't bother me at all. In fact, I actually love the smell of it. And looking at that as a material that's very common. And, you know, part of what I'm doing also is looking at materials that there may be a cultural disgust to that material, and looking at and trying to turn that around and saying, why is there a disgust to this material? Why can't I use horse manure? Why can't I use dead animals? Why can't I use fur? Why can't I use things I pick up from a ditch, and have that be a valued, and valuable cultural piece to who we are as artists and who we are in the West, and playing around with that perception.
And, of course, the materials have some real intrinsic qualities to it that you're using. Mm-hmm. I mean, horse manure, how do you use it?
Well, I think what a lot of it is, I use it in several different ways. Look at how people make adobe. And yesterday I was actually at the Pecos Pueblo, and they're making adobe, so I kind of looked at the brick molds and some of the materials they're doing. And so adobe is a very traditional material of this area. And so I'm making an adobe brick out of that and stacking it, using it for that. I have molds of myself and other body parts and other people, and I wet it and shove it into that and cast it into that. I also, with just the dried pieces, dry them, and I'm going to be gluing them together, sticking them together. And I was talking to you yesterday about putting them on the ground and making a topographical map of that, because they're all different sizes and different contours, and putting that together and really making a geographical reference from that that represents a map of some sort.
I think one of the stereotypes of the Western artist, as you just mentioned, is cowboys and Indians. Another one is people painting majestic landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? I mean, it's not just that you're not doing that. It's that you're really doing something that fits into both of a Western mindset with the materials you're using, but also more of a kind of international conceptual art framework.
Yeah. You know, one of the things, there's an artist that I really love by the name of Richard Serra, and his philosophy is beauty. You know, artists don't set out generally to make something beautiful. Beauty is an individual aesthetic, and beauty is a byproduct of the process. So much of my work for me is very beautiful, because I'm going through the process, the techniques, trying to understand the material, and then defining my own idea of beauty. And that really comes about from so much of the process that I do with that. So I'm not saying I want to paint a very pretty sunset, which has been done 1,000 times. You know, and if people want to do that, that's fine, but that's not what I'm working towards. I'm trying to redefine my nature of beauty and what is beautiful to me and how we value that work and how I can change people's value systems to look at things differently.
How's that going over when you take the work out of the West?
It's actually accepted more out of the West. I get better.
Really?
I get better response because I think it's very for me, it's very common. It's the materials I use are so common, but people look at it, people who don't have contact with it all the time, look at it in a different way. And then suddenly it, instead of being the common material, it's like, wow, let's really think about this. So it's putting it in a different context. I still have a lot of people, I keep using that word cultural distaste, that there's some of the materials I use, a lot of people are disgusted with that. And they're like, well, how can that be? How can a dead animal that you picked up off the road be art? That's, you know, that's not art. How much work does that take? And I'm thinking, well, it takes a whole lot of work to be able to do that and put it in a context that takes it away from being just that material, but then takes it into a higher level of thinking and gives it a new meaning.
Well, presumably you're also doing something with it. You're not just taking roadkill and sticking it on the wall.
No, absolutely. No, I'm changing it. I'm putting it in a different context. I'm adding materials to it in some manner.
Michael Broman is a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. And once again, Thursday, 5:30 in the afternoon. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Stephanie Patton, also a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. She's a multimedia installation artist and performance artist as well, visiting us here from Louisiana. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you have a kind of funny, almost obsession perhaps, with weird stuff out of the catalogs that elderly ladies collect in their houses. And I call that category what no home should be without, like just completely superfluous things, and yet you really examine these things and kind of blow them up larger than life.
Yeah, and I like your motto with that too. They are these, I've been working with these catalogs, gosh, it's probably going on 15 years at this point. So I've done various projects through the catalogs. They were sitting by my grandmother's recliner. When I would go to her house, bored out of my mind, I'd pick one up, and it was a world of information and gadgets and all these crazy things that were really funny but also sort of oddly sad at the same time, geared towards elderly people. You probably know some of these catalogs like Dr. Leonard's or Arizona. Carol Wright is another one.
Lillian Vernon they had when I was young.
I've heard of that one too. Yeah, that seems, they're all those similar type things, like you might open one up, and actually the one that pops out a lot is the extender for getting a canned good out of a cabinet, or just different things that
Or like toe separator for putting on your nail polish,
yes,
without painting the other toes.
Yes. Some of the paintings that I've done recently from these catalogs, one is a cat shelf, which actually I have friends that are like, hey, I have one of those. Well, so the cat can look outside and see the world inside and out.
And so you actually make paintings of some of these objects.
Yes. Yes. That's what I've been doing right now at the Art Institute. I've also made products... made my own in the past. One was the heart pillow, the heart filter, the tear repellent, which was, if you're sick of being the shoulder to cry on, you can wear this...
Tear repellent
under your clothing, so it would repel the tears from someone constantly bringing you down. Now, here at the Santa Fe Art Institute, I've been selecting ones that I find have a special kind of significance to me, to what I'm working on now. This installation idea that I have is sort of a fantasy world of an elderly woman's living room is what I'm going for. So some of these catalog devices or paintings, I imagine in the context of an installation with a lot of white vinyl, puffy, protective devices. So anyway, one of the paintings is the shoulder cozy. Another one
to
is...
To keep your shoulders warm?
Yeah, it's not to be confused with the snuggly blanket that covers your whole body that doubles as a blanket. This is a shoulder cozy. Another one that I'm excited about is the Mountain Cat's Bed Collection. And that one, I'm not putting all of the text that you would see in from the catalog in that one, but it does say, go wild in your bedroom with the Mountain Cat's Bed Collection, which another thing I think is really fun or interesting about these catalogs is that they may have what you would consider sort of risque advertisements along with the cobbler apron or muumuu or, you know, the chin guard. So it's interesting that...
Well, we are all full people
yes.
with our complete sexuality
yes.
until about a day before death,
so,
usually.
Yeah, so I think that's really an interesting part of this, too. And every time I open one of those catalogs, I feel like I'm learning something new, you know.
So you have done, among other things, created a character named Ranella Rose Champagne.
Yes.
Tell us about her.
Ranella goes far back. Actually, Ranella was a character. I had a fake wedding back in 1993, and I had to come up with a name because we went.
What do you mean by a fake wedding?
It was a performance art piece. I had a friend of mine. We were undergrads in college in the painting department, and I said, I told a friend that I wanted to get married, but I didn't have anyone to marry me. And he said, I'll marry you, darling. He's this guy, a friend from Nicaragua. So that was it. We had an eight-month engagement. We had a lot of friends get involved. We put it in the local paper because at the time you could advertise your engagement, and I had to come up with a name. So my name was Ranella Rose Champagne. And we put it in the engagement section. We went to Montgomery Ward's and had the photograph taken. This is really true. And we had to put in the bridesmaids and the groomsmen or whatever. And we had that, and then 8 months later, we actually had the wedding, and I had my bridal portrait, Ranella Rose Champagne, in the paper, too. And everyone thought it was real. That's what was exciting about it. My sister even went to a bridal shower, and some older Cajun lady said, did y'all see this little girl? She was laying on her dress. Because I was laying in the grass in the dress as Ranella. Anyway, that was the birth of Ranella.
If it were a novel, you and the dude would have fallen in love.
Yes.
But that didn't happen.
No, we're still dear friends. He lives in Brooklyn. Anyway, no, we're really good friends. But Ranella has, I've used that character, that was the birth of it, but I've used that character for different projects for the last, really now it's going on 17 years. Also, I mentioned to you the catalog. I did those fantasy lingerie products. I modeled those as Ranella. And then later, when I moved back to Louisiana, I was away for a while, I started doing singing performances as Ranella, as a country, sort of country Ranella, country singer Ranella. So I toured around and did performances for about 3 years pretty seriously in Louisiana.
Was some of it like really trying to be a country music star? Like it?
I think it could be taken. They got very musical, and the thing that I like about Ranella is the line between fantasy and reality. Just like in the wedding, a lot of people thought it was real, and I've been paid to actually perform and sing for what would be considered a real audience, I guess, but I've also done it in a gallery context where people, a lot of them knew what it was. But, I mean, hopefully it's entertaining enough that, you know, it can come across. I like that sort of fantasy of it.
Stephanie Patton is a resident at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Thursday night, 5:30 in the afternoon, you can see her and everybody else's work. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Joy Lynn Davis. She is a painter. She's living in Santa Barbara, California, and is here with the Santa Fe Art Institute Residency Program. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your painting is a very interesting fusion of what you learned from Tibetan Tonka painting and Tibetan painting traditions and very American realist, photorealist art.
Yes, that's correct.
How did you get into this fusion that you're doing now?
Well, quite a few travels landed me in Nepal. I was doing volunteer work there initially and discovered that the town that I was volunteering in was one of the artistic centers for Nepal. And so I quickly found myself in Tonka painting schools and found a teacher who would teach me
So you'd been a painter before that?
I had been a painter before that, but had taken quite a break from painting in order to pursue digital art in school and learn something that I thought would be more profitable and more interesting. But I really didn't enjoy the process of digital art. And so after graduation, I had started traveling. And then coming to Nepal revitalized my interest in painting. And I met so many interesting people there and came back with some knowledge of Tonka painting, and at the same time so many incredible photographs of the people that I had met and spoken with there, and so many stories. And I felt like I needed to find a way to combine the photographs of these interesting people I had met with their traditional style of painting that I had been studying while I was there.
What is Tonka painting?
Tonka is a Tibetan word, and one of the definitions of it is that which can be rolled up. So it's a painting. They're typically paintings. Sometimes you see embroidery work and applique work, but typically they're paintings that can be easily transported and carried around. They're for meditation. They're for the purpose of meditation and for teaching. And so you see them in monasteries most frequently, but occasionally you'll see them in people's homes as well.
And so it's what's so interesting to me is you actually work with the photographs of the people you took and make quite large paintings out of them. So are they life-size or almost life-size? And then they have real Tibetan elements in them, little stylized clouds that are very much as if they were religious paintings.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to paint people life-size because I think that they're more engaging as paintings, as portraits, when they're life-size. But then in the background, I am combining the traditional elements to try to tell a greater story than the photograph alone would tell.
And how does it tell a greater story?
Well, I can, through using the elements of Tonka painting, I can really manipulate the background and do completely different things with it than the photograph alone would do. I can tell more of their history. I can tell their story. But I use the style of the Tonka painting.
Right. And there's some really what seem initially like strange contrasts, like a motorcycle in front of, what is it, a Tibetan temple.
Yeah, and one of the things I'm really interested in is showing Tibet, Nepal, India. I'm showing these places as they really are. They're countries that are in transition. They're not countries that are stuck in the old ways. We think of them, you know, we think of these places as places that never change, as Shangri-La. When in actuality, it's several different cultures being butted up together against modernity and change. And so when there are motorcycles in front of a temple, I paint them exactly as they are. But then the temple, in that particular painting, the temple I used art historical images to show show the temple in a more traditional way. So I'm trying to show both tradition and modernity together.
Now, your goal is to use your work to raise money for art restoration in Tibet and Nepal?
Yeah, that's the long-term goal. After visiting Tibet in 2006, I had the chance to do an art historical survey of Western Tibet, and we ran into so many temples that were in terrible condition. And in some of these temples, they had the money to do restoration, but they didn't have the right skills to do it the way they would have wanted to do it. And so there were times where I saw 13th, 14th century paintings, incredible, incredible detailed paintings being whitewashed and painted over again. And a lot of the best artists have fled Tibet since the Cultural Revolution. And so they just don't have very many talented people to come in and either restore these paintings or to paint over them in a similar quality as to what existed before. And when I would talk to the people there, they often said, but the paintings are so dirty, we don't know how to fix them. And there are conservators who of course are experts in the field who can come in and save these paintings. And I think the timing right now is so desperate that we really need more groups of those people coming in. And there are also groups that are training local people in how to do the cleaning and the restoration of the work, so that then when the experts leave, the local people understand it and know how to do it, and they can really take part in the process. So that's what I would really like to be raising money for.
And the good part is that a lot of these paintings were made to last with the gold leaf and very strong materials.
Mm-hmm, that's true. And they typically use mineral paints. In both the wall paintings and in the portable Tonka paintings and the mineral paints in the climate of Tibet, just similar to the climate of Santa Fe. It's so dry that they'll last hundreds and hundreds of years.
Joy Lynn Davis is a painter, and she's with the Santa Fe Art Institute Residency Program. We will see you on Thursday afternoon.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Marius Lahana. He is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
So I was somewhat horrified and fascinated to find out that you have this habit of drawing while driving.
Yes, I do. And that's the work that I brought to work on at the Art Institute. I do that both on the driver's seat and on the passenger seat.
Oh, well, thank goodness.
So, well,
not the driver's part.
I find it more interesting, though, when I'm in the driver's seat and I only pay, you know, subliminal attention to what I'm doing in the drawing. Interesting things happen when, you know, what you do is not in focus, but, you know, in the peripheral vision. So I found those sketches more useful.
Really?
For my work.
Yeah. What kind of things came out of those sketches that were perhaps unconscious or unexpected?
Well, I think they embody a sense of transience that I'm interested in, because I'm a native of Romania, and I still am in contact with my home culture, but I'm already an outsider to it, and I'm still an outsider to the American culture, so I'm living this in-between, in this in-between place, and I felt that those works captured this sense more accurately.
What is it about driving that somehow is a reflection of that in between, not of one or the other kind of state?
Yes, it is reflective of that narrative that may pop somewhat consciously, somewhat unconsciously in my work, in that it is a metaphor for the condition of the immigrant. You know, you're always in between things, and you are aware of that. It's not that anybody at large would not be in that position. I think everybody is. But it makes you very self-conscious, very conscious of being in transition at all time. Constructing meaning of what happens around you is a very conscious process. And that's also one reason why in my work I use construction materials like cement and very raw processes of drawing and painting.
But cement on paper, which is an unusual combination.
It works well when the cement is latex-based. It dries a little more solid and slightly elastic, more so than the Portland cement. So I've been working with that for a while.
And there's also this phenomenon of when you're driving in the car, even though you're very close to lots of other people, you have no relationship with them except, you know, from in whatever this sort of weird language of cars is, or language
right.
of driving is, which is often very different from your normal way of communicating.
Right. I think you do have a relation with the others around you, but the car is this interesting psychological entity that makes one feel more anonymous while driving. We behave slightly differently, or widely differently,
or sometimes very yeah.
when driving, partly because the car gives us a sense of anonymity, as if it's the car itself that's in movement and not the intelligence behind it driving it. And I also feel that that's a good reflection of the split between our public persona and our intimate self, which intimate part is the part that often surfaces in artwork. Nevertheless, as soon as it's exhibited, it has a public dimension. So, you know, the artwork itself is the car.
Right, right. Interesting. Have you ever been stopped for drawing while driving?
No, but Probably that should be.
Or heaven forbid had an accident?
No. But I wouldn't advise anybody to try that.
No, children, young adults, adolescents, parents, and grandparents, do not try this in your car.
Yeah.
And so the imagery, of course, has lots of street scenes, some of the interior things of the car, backwards signage as reflected mm-hmm. in mirrors and things like that.
Yes, and overall, the idea of layering and of the fact that this is, again, in relation with my sense of identity, which is stratified. I'm a Romanian on the one hand. I'm operating in an American culture. I have an Indian wife from East.
From India.
From India. So there are all these layers that influence who I am. And I feel that the layering that happens in my work is reflective of that. It incorporates a sense of history, a sense of memory, a sense of temporality, incompleteness, which I think is a correct reflection of the world. Visual art has this, you know, inevitable reliance on sight. For the most part, I think contemporary art is questioning that more and more, and I do too in my practice, because sight tends to unify the world. You know, whatever you look upon tends to get unity from the fact that it's seen, while touch, and that's something that I try to emphasize by using those construction materials. Touch makes you aware that what you are perceiving through touching is a fragment, is incomplete.
Marius Lahaina is artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. We'll see you Thursday at 5:30.
Thank you.
I'd like now to welcome Meredith Nicky, artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
So your work is exploring a lot of big ideas about conquest and belonging and disenfranchisement and the role of art in all of that.
Yes.
And you're doing it in ways that are both conceptual and very visual.
Yeah, I think that that's really what's exciting, is to actually almost seduce the viewer into the work and have something that's really compelling about it, so that you engage on it initially on just a visceral sort of immediate level. And then as you sort of unravel what that meaning may be, it's sort of a more slow sort of conceptual process of investigating what those forms actually communicate. And I think that that's a tension that I always want to be inherent in my work.
When you have, you're starting with these, you know, as you call them, seductive forms and very sensual and visceral forms, how do you use text, or how do you communicate the other layers of meaning that you want those forms to convey?
Well, I haven't actually used text, and a lot of people have talked to me about that, because there's a lot of research that I do initially for each project, but I don't actually present that in a very sort of literal manner. And I think partly that's because I don't necessarily think that that the viewer has to decode every particular aspect of the work. And I do like them to bring their own meanings to the work. And so I never want it to become a kind of didactic exercise where someone feels that they're almost being subjected to something. I really want there to be a real exchange taking place with the work. And it's not to say that text doesn't allow for that, but I'm much more interested in the sort of aesthetic possibilities that kind of communication can evoke. So
you're using something called, how do you say?
Chinoiserie.
Chinoiserie, thank you. What is that, and how are you using it?
Well, it's a decorative art form that was most popular in the mid sort of 18th century. And it's kind of a cultural pastiche, so that at the time when there was a huge advent of trade between Europe and East Asia specifically, they would adopt all of these different influences of Asian culture, but nothing was within its particular context. So it became this kind of self-fashioning project, a kind of fantastical space. And it's very much tied to ideas of desire and also notions of the other. But in fact, that really reflects the person who's making the production itself. And so I'm kind of interested in the sort of historical ambiguities and racial complexities of that dynamic and how it also sort of is a real embodiment of symbolic capital and what was occurring at that time.
What do you mean by symbolic capital?
I think that it relates back to the ideas of conquest, where not only are you traversing terrain and sort of forging new economic sort of trade alliances, but also that you're actually refashioning a particular subject, a particular culture. And in many ways, things that weren't seen to be sufficiently exotic were then sort of inflated even more so. So that there's a kind of power dynamic within that. And it's very much an assertion of space and a sort of reconstitution of value. And so in that way, it becomes a form of symbolic capital.
How do you sort out the power dynamic from the natural phenomenon of different cultures touching and being influenced by each other?
I think, well, that's what I think that is engaging about this, because it doesn't become a sort of us and them, a very easy sort of delineation. And part of what attracted me to chinoiserie is the fact that it's so ubiquitous today. And
what does it look like, so people can, on the radio, can contextualize this?
It's sort of all of these sort of iconic forms, these indexical forms of like pagodas, dragons, Indian stupas.
Okay.
But in these very, like, flourished, sort of fanciful incarnations, okay. Over the top,
right.
Completely over the top. And so there were many architectural buildings, like these architectural follies, that were just about kind of inserting this completely wild imagination of the exotic.
And so, but again, the question of where's the power, how do you locate and describe the power dynamic as opposed to just like, wow, dragons, that's so cool.
Right. Well, I think that's what's intriguing about it, because in some ways it seems like it's almost a commemoration or an adulation of these forms, but yet at the same time, because it has no particular commitment to what the meanings of those forms are, and that this reconfiguration takes on something else entirely, that it becomes a sort of abusive power in many respects. And I think that it's quite intriguing how that develops over time and like who adopts those forms for what ends and what purposes.
Well, much more to talk about, but we're out of time. Meredith Nicki is an artist in residence at the Santa Fe Art Institute. We'll see you Thursday evening. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And finally, I'd like to welcome Stefan Chinov. He is an artist in residence, native of Bulgaria, Santa Fe Art Institute. Welcome.
Thank you.
So you are both a sculptor and you draw and do two-dimensional work, and there's a very close relationship between those two things.
Correct. They sort of play off each other, and the three-dimensional work appears in the drawings, and then the drawings inform the three-dimensional work. Both deal with somewhat of a formal view over the way we perceive things in the world around us, the way we load objects with all sorts of personal desires, memories, things like this, and then the that's sort of where the drawing comes in. It's more of a contemplation on this. Not really existing things that we see in objects.
Not really existing things that we see in objects?
Right.
Well, like what?
Well, I can't give a specific example, really, because it's different for everyone, but...
But, like, for you?
I guess things that I remember, either from my past in my country, or things that I desire now and I cannot get, or things that... I just somehow feel are coming from an object, like a memory of a place, of a specific place, which, interesting enough, springs from a different place, which actually has nothing to do with this.
So you're working with metal and wood and plexiglass and very what you might call modern art materials.
Right. These are the materials that I use in my sculpture. I use them to build constructions that are somewhat architectural, but then they also work as a three-dimensional drawing to a certain extent at this point. That's why you can see a sort of a skeleton that is built out of these metal bars or wood pieces. And they indicate planes and movements in space, and they're like a bridge to me between the original thinking and what I abstract out of it.
Unfortunately, it's time to go, but people can see this and much more at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Open studios are Thursday night. Thank you, Stefan, for being with us. And Michelle, once again, Thursday at 5:30 in the afternoon, Santa Fe Art Institute.
Yes.
Telephone number 424-5050. Website sfai.org. And also
sfaiblog.org is where you sort of can keep up on what's going on. And there's a Facebook page that I've been trying desperately to keep up. If you're interested, just search Santa Fe Art Institute on Facebook.
Michelle LaFlamme-Childs, thanks for being with us, and thanks to all the residents. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. My email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. I do not at this point have a phone number. If you have called and tried to leave a message, please just email me, because that message box is not working. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org. And podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team under the marvelous direction of Bill Dupuis. And after that, jazz.